Does that sound like a robot, or does that sound like AI? Does that sound synthetic? Does that sound human? When we think about it, we can't tell. But when we rely more on those primal, very basic human responses, we can tell. And what's fascinating to me is even after we told people which voice was which, they still couldn't tell the difference between two voices. But again, on a subconscious basis, they could. And so just a fascinating piece of research that is definitely time boxed, right? I think these voice generators will get better in quality.
They will,
But
but will
there's
the connection be there?
exactly.
Welcome to Audio Branding, the hidden gem of marketing. Sound plays a more important role in human behavior and our decision-making than you may realize. In this podcast, I'll help you understand the art and science of sound so you can better influence others in business and your life. I'm your host, Jody Krangle. Let's delve a little deeper. Here's the first part of my conversation with Joe Sauer. My next guest is a man who proves you don't need to be a rock star to master sonic branding. So, how does a guy with no musical talent become an expert on all things audio? Data, data, and more data. He's devoted his career to understanding the impact of emotion on consumer decision-making. For the last decade or so, he's focused specifically on optimizing the impact of sound and music in branding, advertising, and user experience design. His award-winning neuro-based research approach has become the gold standard for audio measurement, partnering with top sound studios globally to ensure that brands don't just sound good, but actually resonate with their audiences. His name is Joe Sauer, and through our discussion today, we'll enter the world of beats, brands, and brainwaves to understand some of the hard science behind audio branding. As always, if you have questions for my guest, you're welcome to reach out through the links in the show notes. If you have questions for me, visit audiobrandingpodcast.com, where you'll find a lot of ways to get in touch. Plus, subscribing to the newsletter will let you know when the new podcasts are available and what the newest audio chats will be about. And if you're getting some value from listening, the best ways to show your support are to share this podcast with a friend and leave an honest review. Both those things really help, and I'd love to feature your review on future podcasts. You can leave one either in written or in voice format from the podcast's main page. I would so appreciate that. And now, here's my conversation with Joe Sauer.
Hey, Joe, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jody.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this because there is so much information that you have that I want to share with people who are interested in sound, especially. But to get us started, I want to ask you if you have an early memory of how sound moved you.
Early memory. I think, like most people, my early memories are, especially of sound, are all centered around anxiety, kind
okay.
of, you know, the social acceptance. And I think really the first time that I became very viscerally aware of the emotional impact with sound of sound was really at a like a junior prom or, you know, a high school dance type thing. And, you know, as is the case when you're dealing with social pressures and the anxieties of your teenage years, you know, you're painfully aware of opportunities for embarrassment.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So when I was growing up, the prom ending or the dance ending slow dance was always Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin.
Yes.
And so when the first few bars of Stairway to Heaven would come on, everybody looked like a deer in the headlights because they didn't want to be left without a dance partner.
Yes.
And so, you know, that was that, like I said, that very visceral anxiety and fear of embarrassment and then relief that floods in when you find yourself with a partner on the dance floor. It was all triggered by music, by it, not even a full song, just the first couple of bars of music. And so that was probably the earliest memory I have of music really impacting my emotional state, my mood, my well-being, And to this day, that song, the first few bars of that song, trigger those memories for me and take me back to that time and cause all of those emotions that I was feeling at that time to flood back as if it were yesterday. And I can assure you, it wasn't yesterday.
Yes, I totally get it. Yeah, you're reliving that moment. It's fantastic. Yeah. I remember that song, but I also remember it morphing into Phil Collins' I Can Feel It Coming.
Yeah, In the Air Tonight.
Yeah, In the Air Tonight.
Best drum solo, according to Billboard.
Yes, definitely. Awesome. But yeah, that was, so that became our last song. Mm. I remember in the beginning it was Stairway to Heaven, though. Yeah.
I'm not sure what kids do these days. They probably just sit back with their phones and dance by themselves.
I don't know. Maybe. They're listening to a lot of stuff that I guess other people aren't hearing. I think maybe, you know, I like to hope that maybe there's a bit more individuality.
Well, there was a craze a few years ago that called silent dancing or silent disco,
yes,
where you would go and dance with your headphones on and you would dance to your own music. And so somebody could be swaying back and forth very gently and somebody could be moshing and, you know, thrashing around. So not sure that's my bag, but,
I know.
To your point about individuality, you know, everybody has their own unique reaction to music generally and then to specific pieces of music. And so that, it, you know, that very individualized response is something that, you know, we're going to talk more about today.
Yeah, definitely. So you've started working in sound in a lot of capacities. Mm-hmm. So what got you interested in that? What was the progression? I mean, you had that childhood memory of the last song, but then, you know, where did that go into what you're doing now?
Well, I've always loved music and I've always had kind of sidelines or side hustles in and around the music industry. As someone who really doesn't have any musical talent at all, I've always kind of been a little starstruck by people who can get on stage, not by specific individuals, but anybody who can get on stage and master a crowd through this instrument. That instrument could be their voice, as in the case of voiceover artists like you, singers. It can be, you know, any kind of musical instrument. And it just, it goes beyond a stage presence. There's something else at work there, more than just, you know, charisma or a magnetic personality. This ability to express ideas and thoughts and concepts and feelings and emotions through an instrument is an unbelievable talent, and I've always been awestruck by it. And so I guess my interest in sound really stems from those early days of trying to figure out how I could be a hanger-on, as it were, to, you know, local bands and eventually, you know, morphing into supporting touring bands and things like that.
That's great. Yeah. Actually, Sean, our remote producer here, was asking me before we started here if you could explain Taylor Swift. I thought it was an interesting question. I would be curious as to your insights into how her phenomenon has really happened. But yeah, I mean, neuromarketing, like from there, I mean, I definitely want to hear your thoughts on Taylor Swift. But sure. Yeah, neuromarketing, I guess, does that explain it?
Well, it does. You know, anytime you see fandom, whether it's in sports or, mm-hmm. you know, entertainment or any field, that avidity is really triggered by an emotional response. And emotions are really the domain of our subconscious. You know, we really can't consciously fully explain why we feel the way we do, why certain emotions are triggered. And oftentimes we're not even aware that those forces, those mechanisms are even at work. And so, you know, Taylor Swift really started with, you know, solid musical bona fides. You know, she started out with some talent. So her fandom would be very different from mine, for example, with no musical talent. But I think what really put her over the top as a breakout, you know, she's no longer, you know, in the top tier. She's now the gold standard of music from a business perspective, regardless of what you think of her from a musical perspective. But what really put her over the top was the battle she had to reclaim control of her own music, of the rights to her music. Mm-hmm. And I think that was that gave her a relatability and an underdog factor. You know, the old expression, we all love to root for an underdog. And that's what really pushed her from, you know, a good musician who had catchy music and relatable lyrics to someone who is now reached, you know, the iconoclastic status. And it just snowballs. You know, she has a great team around her, particularly on social media, that continue to engage in thoughtful, purposeful, meaningful ways. And because she controls her music, you know, the rights to her music, she now has the ability to be more thoughtful about where and how that music appears. And so she makes really good business decisions, from a fan management, from a, you know, a base management, if you want to call them those her customers, if you will. Fans are really just customers, when you look at the business side of the music industry. And
that
so
makes a lot of sense.
She's,
yeah.
She's done a good job.
Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating to see the rise of her stardom because, wow. But yeah, I have, whether or not I feel anything about her music, I very much appreciate her business acumen. There is something to be said for coming to the decision that you need to re-record your music in order to own it.
Yeah.
Like that's a logical leap that maybe not a lot of people would do.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's very true.
I'm really impressed.
When it comes to the neuro side of recorded music, commercial music, there are artists who have started to incorporate the kind of neuro-based testing into musical tracks that are really at the rough cut stage and almost the demo stage. Adele was pretty famous on, I think it was 21, for actually doing using neuro-based techniques. I think, you know, her team used EEG, electroencephalography, to monitor brain response over time to those tracks. And I haven't, you know, talked to her team that did that testing, but I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, movie trailers, which are, you know, as much about the music, you know, the big Hollywood cinema music as anything else going on the screen, have used neuro-based testing approaches for years. How can I, you know, create a 60-second trailer or, you know, 120-second trailer that is the most compelling, attention-grabbing, you know, incentive to go see the movie?
Sure.
And so very much in the same way that we talked about Taylor Swift triggering an emotional response based on her situation, the little story of a trailer, the 60 or 120 second story that's told in that trailer, does the same thing. And so anytime emotion influences behavior, it behooves us to really study that emotional response and find ways to optimize it for the behavioral outcome that we're looking for.
Are you looking for ways to improve your company's or podcast's impact? You'd be surprised how powerful the use of an intentional audio branding strategy can be. Want to know more? I have a free downloadable PDF that gives you my 5 tips for implementing an intentional audio strategy at voiceoversandvocals.com/audio-branding-strategy. That location does ask to put you on a mailing list, just to send you updates on when the new podcasts come out. But if you really don't want to give your email out, I understand. Just contact me directly. My email is all over my website, and I'll make sure you get that PDF without needing to sign up anywhere. If you do sign up, though, you also get access to a resources section called The Studio, where I have videos, white papers and PDFs, discounts from my guests, and snippets of audio from my guests that no one else gets to hear. So maybe it's worth your while. Totally up to you. And of course, if you're looking for voiceovers, you can get in touch with me about that too. Now, back to the podcast.
So it really is fascinating, the neuroscience that goes into this, definitely into sound in general, and very cool to hear that Adele actually was using that kind of psychology and the actual sounds to deeper connect with her audience, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
But when it comes to neuromarketing research, I mean, is it complicated? Is it like, it seems like it's something that would be kind of intimidating to get into. Is there a way that, you know, our regular everyday humans can make this more accessible? Or how would you suggest people understand this?
Yeah, I certainly understand how it can seem so intimidating. I mentioned, you know, EEG, you know, an electrode cap around your head, or fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, where we, you know, you slide someone into a tube and, you know, hear these pinging sounds as we're taking cross-sectional images of your brain. It all sounds very invasive and intimidating. Historically, that was really the only way that those kind of neurometric techniques, where we're observing brain activity directly, they were the only way that we could really understand whether any kind of stimulus, auditory, visual, you know, gustatory, olfactory, whether any kind of stimulus was triggering an emotional response. Fortunately, and this is where I come in, over the last 10 or 15 years, we've been looking at ways to isolate and quantify the emotional response, particularly to sound, audio, music, voice, whatever it happens to be, but audio, and understand what impact that emotional response has on shaping my preferences and influencing my choices or my decisions. And the techniques that we've evolved are much less intimidating. They're actually very, very sophisticated psychology experiments, but they're gamified. They're hidden in a word or an image sorting game, which does a couple of important things. Principally, it removes the respondent's ability to actually manipulate the response data. If you think about, you know, if you've ever participated in surveys in the past, they typically pose a question, whether it's somebody standing in front of you at a mall, or, you know, you're taking a survey online or on your mobile phone, whatever it happens to be. Somebody poses you a question and you're given the opportunity to think about your response. You're not being timed. You're not given a time limit within which to respond. And what that allows you to do as the respondent, whether you're doing it purposefully or not, is filter your response through a whole series of biases. We often find, and we've just had, you know, a great example in our election where the opinion polls got it wrong. And one of the reasons they got it wrong is we have very divisive candidates that people are reluctant to admit that they're voting for on either side. And so when they're asked the question, they often provide responses that are idealized versions of themselves or what their friends would think if their friends knew they were answering a question in this way. And that happens in high engagement categories like, you know, chocolate and alcohol, but it also happens in the most banal categories as well, like folding tables or playing cards. You know, it's emotion, our emotional responses have a massive influence over our decisions. And so
how do you prevent that gamification is what I'd like to know. Yeah,
sure. We actually use a technique called implicit association testing, which is essentially an image sorting game. You're asked, in the simplest form of the experiment, you're asked to sort labeled emoticons into one of two categories. Is this emotion positive or negative? And so you'll see, for example, happiness will come up, and you have to correctly sort that. It's a cognitive judgment, meaning there's a right or wrong answer. Mm-hmm. So you have to exert reason and logic to come up with the right answer. That's a very conscious process. And so disgust might come up, and you have to correctly sort that into the negative category. And we do this over the course of about 30 seconds just to train you what's happening in the game. We're also, during that training stage, that initial 30 seconds, we're calculating on average how long it takes you to correctly sort a positive emotion into the positive bucket and a negative emotion into the negative bucket. And believe it or not, it actually takes us marginally longer, measurably, but marginally longer to accurately sort negative emotions than positive emotions. And so we calculate those separately.
Interesting.
We then engage in about a 2 to 3 minute experiment, which is identical in nature. Your cognitive task is identical. You'll see these labeled emoticons or emojis, and you have to sort them correctly into the positive or negative bucket. But this time we're actually priming you. Priming is when you're exposed to some sort of sensory input that's completely unrelated to your cognitive judgment. And so we can prime you with a visual image, like a brand logo, or we can prime you with a short form sonic asset, like a UX UI sound or a sonic logo, anything that's, you know, 2.5, 3 seconds or shorter tends to work very effectively. And so you're primed intermittently with these stimuli, and then the stimuli goes away and your sorting task comes back. And the subconscious response you've had to that stimulus actually makes it easier or harder to make the correct cognitive judgment, even though the stimulus had nothing to do with the correct answer that you're being asked to come up with. And so, for example, let's say I have I hear the sound of my car alarm going off. We're testing this in the experiment. I hear the sound of a car alarm go off. I'm already mentally preparing to sort the stimulus I just heard into the negative category, right? Because I was priming you, or I was conditioning you rather, in the early round, that if something's negative, it goes into the negative category. If something's positive, I sort it into the positive category. So if I hear a car alarm, I'm already mentally preparing, without even realizing, I'm mentally preparing to sort a negative emotion. But let's say happiness comes up. I have to consciously override my subconscious urge to push that into the sort that into the negative category to correctly sort it into the positive category. And so even though the differences may just be milliseconds, that process of overriding something that I'm planning to do, it's measurable. And it also is truly isolating the emotional response. If it takes me longer, I'm having a stronger emotional response to whatever that stimulus was. And so over the course of, as I said, about 2 or 3 minutes of rotating in on an experimentally controlled basis, different sounds or different images or different lockups, a visual image paired with a sonic logo, I'm able to actually quantify both the valence of my emotional response, was it positive or negative, and the intensity, or what psychologists call arousal. So how strongly positive or strongly negative was my emotional response to that particular piece of stimulus? And I said the stimulus can be either audio, video, or the combination of audio and video. And that's how we quantify the impact, emotional impact of sonic logos or UX, UI sounds, any kind of short form sonic asset that I've got. We then take that a step further and understand what emotional response is to the brand without the sound, and then the emotional response to the brand combined with the sound. And obviously the difference between those two is attributable to the presence of the sound, because we test everything else is identical. So the only difference is the presence of the sound. And what we've shown through empirical validation is that the emotional, the differential emotional appeal of the sound in a sonic environment is actually very highly correlated, more highly correlated than any other research metric, with behaviors, consumer, real world consumer behaviors. So the likelihood to buy a product, the likelihood to pay a premium for that product, likelihood to buy that product again and again and again, in other words, integrate it into my life. And it all comes down to being able to quantify the behavioral impact of the sound. And so what we talk about in audio testing is it's the critical element that links emotion to action. And that's really what marketers are hoping to do, whether you are, you know, a marketer in the music industry like Adele or Taylor Swift, or whether you're a marketer in the commercial world, like McDonald's or Nike or, you know, whoever, Coca-Cola, trying to link that emotional response to actions. And this is the one technique that's shown an ability to do that.
I really appreciate you being here. Know anyone that you think would make a great guest for this podcast? Someone who works in sound on behalf of clients? Please do get in touch. I'd love to hear about them. Your recommendations are always super helpful. And now back to the show.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally fascinating to me that it has that much of an impact. It's amazing.
It does, yeah.
But what happens if you're trying to research longer form musical tracks and things like that? Like, can you get more quantifiable data on things that are longer than 2 or 3 seconds, let's say?
We can. And so if you think about long form music in a commercial environment, in a business environment, that's typically taking the form of some sort of advertising, the audio element of some sort of advertising. So it could be a musical score. It could be a voice track, a voiceover read. It could be sound effects. There are all sorts of audio elements to an ad. And really, at one of the great parts about using techniques like this is that it puts the focus on the consumers' attitudes and perceptions of the brand, as opposed to their attitudes and perceptions of the music itself, right?
Yes.
And so in a situation like you described, where I need this longer form exposure, what we do is implement what we call a split cell, split sample, where half the sample, and the two samples are demographically balanced. So we're talking to roughly the same kind of set of people. But one group is exposed to the brand without exposure to the musical element of the ad. And another group is exposed to the ad in, you know, rough cut, final cut kind of stage. And we look at the difference between those two. And so does preference for the brand, does the likelihood to consider and purchase that brand increase with piece of music A, piece of music B, piece of music C, and which provides the greatest lift? And you can either do that in comparison. So I've got two tracks, or I've got two voiceover artists, or what have you, and I want to see which one outperforms. Mm-hmm. But you can also do it just in comparison to a beta case where there's no audio at all. And so you really start to understand what impact the audio is having, not just on the quality of the narrative, the storytelling aspects of the ad itself, but really more importantly from the people who are paying for the ad, on the likelihood that brand is actually going to be purchased the next time the respondent or the consumer is in market.
Yeah, it's really fascinating stuff. We were talking also in our pre-chat a little bit about AI and synthetic mm-hmm. voices and, mm-hmm. and stuff like that.
Yep.
And you had said that you had done some research on the subconscious and conscious reaction, I guess, to synthetic voices. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little more about that.
Sure. You know, there's been a lot of hand-wringing in the music industry about AI's abilities to actually create music with mm-hmm. no human involvement at all.
Yeah.
Whether that's synthetic voices in the case of narration, right on through to, you know, multi-layered, multi-instrumented, you know, songs, if for lack of a better description. And so the easiest part of this to test was really voice. And what we wanted to do was use some of the voice generators, you know, early generation voice generators, from an AI perspective, to compare live reads. So we digitized, five lines, you know, five phrases, if you will. And we had them, we had four human beings of various genders and nationalities, accents, and so on. And we had four different AI-created versions of the same phrases. And when we tested them consciously, explicitly, the vast majority of participants were not able to accurately classify whether the phrase they just heard was AI-generated or human, synthetic or human.
Mm-hmm.
And so consciously, it all sounds the same. But when we started to isolate and quantify the subconscious response, the accuracy shot way up. And most respondents were able to accurately identify whether a voice they heard was synthetic or human on a subconscious basis. There was just something that we're not even aware is happening, that's subconscious, below the level of conscious awareness,
mm-hmm.
Just something in the AI process that's losing humanity. And we may not be able to hear it, you know, when we're actively attuned to it and we're consciously thinking about it and we're thinking, does that sound like a robot, or does that sound like AI? Does that sound synthetic? Does that sound human? When we think about it, we can't tell. But when we rely more on those primal, very basic human responses, we can tell. And what's fascinating to me is even after we told people which voice was which, they still couldn't tell the difference between two voices. But again, on a subconscious basis, they could. And so just a fascinating piece of research that is definitely time boxed, right? I think these voice generators will get better in quality.
They will, but will the connection be there?
Exactly. Is there something just basically human about the human voice that simply can't be replicated without, you know, at least the seed track being a real human being recording it and then modified, but entirely generated from scratch? We're definitely not there yet. And it's my fervent hope that we never get there. I think there's, you know, something very human about being human that we need to preserve. But I don't want to verge into philosophy too much. That's a different podcast.
Well, no, I mean, we will definitely get philosophical here. I have no problem with that at all. But yeah, I mean, as a voice actor, I have to say I'm a little biased. I mean, obviously. Yeah. But the whole idea that there is actually a seed there that we connect with in the way that we communicate with one another, that whether it's conscious or unconscious, we know if we're talking to another human being.
Yeah.
That's fascinating to me. Yeah. Are there actual numbers on that? Like, did you actually like have some research that had full numbers on that?
Hello. I'm Cheryl Halling, and I'm here to endorse my podcasting colleague and friend, Jody Krangle. Jody has a true passion to educate and inform her listeners of the power of sound in our lives by welcoming unique and interesting guests that offer their own experience of how sound plays a role in the work they do. I encourage you to add her podcast into your listening repertoire. I believe that you'll understand the importance of sound in a fresh new way.
We did.
Yeah.
There's a bit of, I have to explain the scale a little bit before I provide the numbers.
Sure.
But essentially, think about a scale starting at zero, where zero is no value at all. Scores over zero up to one represent human. And scores under zero to negative one represents synthetic, what we'll call synthetic. We didn't call it that in testing. The implicit response to the four human voices, both the individual voices and in the aggregate, was up at about 0.8. And so they were accurately being flagged as human voices. The synthetic voices were actually, again, both individually and in the aggregate, scored at about a minus 0.3. So less convinced, if you will, less certain of the response, but still being accurately classified as synthetic voices. And so what that means is on a subconscious basis, when I hear a human voice, I'm absolutely certain that it's triggering something in subconsciously that says this is a human voice. When I hear a synthetic voice, I'm less sure, but I can still accurately classify it as a synthetic voice. And again, on a subconscious base or on a conscious basis, the ability to tell was all over the map, right? There was no voice or no type of voice that got above a random assignment of kind of 50%. So they kind of varied between 45 to 55% accuracy, which is basically random. And they followed, you know, the distribution of responses followed a normal bell curve, which means that people were really, they were just guessing at that point. They just weren't sure and they weren't correct.
This has been part one of our interview. I hope you'll tune in next week for part two. Well, that's the end of this episode. Thanks for listening. And if you like what you heard, why not tell a friend about this podcast? It's available in all the usual locations. Until next time.